If I can have your attention, while you continue finishing up with your breakfast, we'll go ahead and get started with our program this morning. We have a number of announcements to make, and I want to leave a maximum amount of time available for our speaker this morning. I'm Jonathan Wilson, president of our FFBC, and I want to welcome all of you to another meeting of the FFBC, an association of gay and bisexual men and the largest private breakfast club in the state of Iowa. I want to report to you that our scholarship fundraising effort has been successful, and we're coming in right around $20,000 that we've raised for scholarships. So we should be... We should be in good shape for another crop of young scholars who have done remarkable things to educate about LGBT issues and advocate for our community. And we will be meeting them and their families at our meeting in June. So it's something really to look forward to. And I want to thank all of you who have been contributors. And it's never too late if you haven't gotten around to making a contribution to the scholarship program. They're still being accepted. It has been something of a tradition to introduce or have someone introduce themselves who is here for the first time. It's not a requirement, but if there are those who are here for the first time, and I know there are two or three in the room, you are welcome to be introduced by your host, or you can introduce yourself. Anyone? Well, those of you who are regulars, if you will look around and look for unfamiliar faces, make sure that they have a good time, have good experience, and join us again in the future. On the piano back here in the corner is our book exchange. There's no checkout system. There are some good books out there. Harlan's Race, for example, is one that I highly recommend. It's the first sequel to Front Runner. And they are both great books, and one of them is in the library there. If you have books that you would be willing to share, just get those to us. I want to thank my partner, Scott Cookneo, for coordinating our book exchange. Let's see. On the table in the foyer, there is a sheet where you can write down the names of people that you think might be interested in participating in FFBC, and if we have that information, we will extend a personal invitation to them to encourage their participation. I encourage you also to check out our website, ffbciowa.org. It is being constantly updated, thanks to Brian Taylor Carlson. And on that site, if you are interested in hearing our speaker again, or because you missed a meeting, you want to hear the speaker, there is an audio recording of our speakers on the website. If you did not receive an RSVP email regarding this meeting, it's because we don't have current accurate information about your email address. So if you didn't get an RSVP reminder, if you will get your updated correct email information to me, you will in the future be receiving those notifications. Then we have a number of other notices and announcements. Marcus Turnage has something for next Monday. Marcus, there we are.
Iowa State Schools is having our Rainbow Club, which was rescheduled from January 11th, at the Come and Go Theater at the Des Moines Social Club this Monday, March 5th. We will have all seven gubernatorial candidates there, as well as two libertarian candidates, and I want to stress that all candidates are welcome to participate in the Rainbow Club.
What time?
There is a social from 6 to 7, and the forum starts at 7:05.
Great. Thanks, Marcus. Next, Bob Thalen has an announcement regarding First United Methodist Church. Bob.
First United Methodist Church, downtown Des Moines, 10th and Pleasant Streets, is having a Latin music series. And the first one was this past Wednesday of this week, but there are three more, March 7th, 14th, and 21st. They take place at 5:30. And they end promptly at 6 o'clock. This coming Wednesday is Amy Christensen, who will play the oboe in concert. On the 14th of March, Dana Slaughter, who is a graduate of Drake University, at clarinet. And then on March 21st, Maz, a harpist. And these are all professional musicians and very competent, so we hope that maybe a few of you can make it. That's 10th of Pleasant Street, First United Methodist Church, next 3 Wednesdays at 5:30. Thank you.
A number of years ago, when I was straight, I was the lay leader of that church. It is located just east of here, and it's the one with the lighted rotating cross. Next, I will call on Rick Miller, who has a couple of announcements. Rick.
The first one I'd like to make is for the Des Moines Demons Chorus. The concert this season is very early. It usually takes place in late March or early April, but it's coming up on the 10th of March. They are doing the Tyler Suite, which is a masterwork in which several major composers here in the United States have put together a several movement piece. Tyler Clementi is the person who is being honored with this masterwork. He was the college student whose roommate filmed him having sex with another man and then put it on the internet, causing him so much pain that he took his life by jumping from the Narrows Bridge. This piece is honoring him, not suicide, and it is a piece that will bring you hope for the future. I hope you will make time to go to this concert at Chesil Auditorium. There's one performance only. It's Saturday on March 10th. The second thing I'd like to point out is that the Pride Center has now got its summit together, and Pink Harvey, who's working with Ellie Krug from Minneapolis, a transgender woman, is creating this one vision, one voice event at the Botanical Center, which should be lovely. And our own Gary Moore is one of the keynote speakers for this. We even heard you on the fact that the FBI may be there to actually answer questions for you. They're trying to be very proactive in making sure that our community has all the answers to any questions we may have. So I think it's an important one, and it will involve a lot of leadership building and leadership skills for the younger generation. So hope you can make that. Thank you.
So the FBI apparently hasn't heard from the president. Okay. Next, our next board meeting is next Wednesday at 6:15 at Scott's in my home, 2924 Druid Hill. All members are welcome if you are interested in attending. That's next Wednesday the 7th. Our newsletter copy deadline for our monthly newsletter is March the 12th, and that's a week from next Monday. So if you are a regular contributor, there's your time deadline. And for anyone else who has something on your mind, it would probably be of interest to others, put it down, and we will edit and polish and make it look great, and people will really be impressed with your thoughts and the way you expressed it. So if you will get me your copy by the 12th, we will get it into our newsletter. Let's see, I just wanted to mention also Iowa Stage. This is the final weekend for the its production of A View from the Bridge at the Come and Go Theater. So that's tonight, 7:30, tomorrow night at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Something that might be of interest to you. Also, Prime Timers has a full schedule of activities for the remainder of the month, and that schedule is now conveniently put on your tables at every FFBC meeting. Rather than have me try and rattle them off and give you the detailed information, it's all there as to time, date, and location. And then save the date. The One Iowa Gala is coming up. There's an announcement on that on your tables as well. I think that's April the 13th. Friday, April the 13th. So plan on that going forward. And with that, I will turn again to Marcus Turnage to introduce our speaker for this morning. Marcus.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Our next speaker is the president of Selzer & Company, a firm that specializes in research for clients who seek meaningful ways to communicate with their audiences, be they readers, viewers, voters, or lawmakers, even people like you. She's been dubbed the gold standard of what's happening in Iowa. She might also be called the outlier queen. She rocketed to national fame for her poll just ahead of the 2008 caucuses, showing Barack Obama as the clear winner. She's gotten used to being alone in her final poll findings with the Santorum surge in the 2012 Republican caucuses, Joni Ernst's definitive victory in 2014, and Bernie Sanders' near miss in the 2016 Democratic caucuses, just to name a few. She left Iowa shortly after earning her doctorate at the University of Iowa to become a senior analyst for a major public opinion firm in Washington, D.C. She joined the staff of the Register in 1987, just before the 1988 caucuses. She directed the poll and supported the advertising staff through market research as a Register staffer until 1992, when she left and get to give her full-time attention to her company, returning to direct the poll as a contractor in 1997. Please welcome J. Ann Selzer.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to see some faces I know, some faces I hope to soon know. I feel a little bit like Rebecca Gruber, who is the conductor of the Gay Men's Chorus. So that's I promise not to sing. You mentioned, Jonathan, that your board meeting was at 6:15. I presume that would be a.m. I don't know of any other clubs that meet at 7. I was reminded there was a political party where you can help me with the name of that party. The rent is two. Do you remember this? See, I don't use profanity, but I will. The rent is too damn high. Remember that party?
Oh, yeah.
The meeting is too damn early, but here I am. Now, am I right? Now, I know you guys can sort of roll out of bed at what, 6:30 and be here by 7? Some of us, it takes a little bit more time. Okay, that will conclude my bitchy part of the day, I guess. So I came to talk to you about more serious things, more sobering things. I'm a fan of Hamilton, so maybe you'll see a few allusions here. This is much of this is based on a speech I gave to the Iowa Bankers Association in September of 2016, kind of helping them see what I thought was coming at the time. How many Hamilton people do we have here, Hamiltonized? Okay, sorry for the rest of you, the few of you, you'll, what comes next? Okay, again, I promise not to sing. Okay, so just a little bit of how did we get here. You recall the famous line from the Bill Clinton war room, James Carville, it's the economy, stupid. I said if you there were going to be a similar sign in the last round, it would be it's the electorate, stupid. And really, I've been saying that for many, 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 many election cycles. Pay attention to who's the electorate. And really, in my mind, was an episode from MASH, which I could play this clip, but I'll just act this out for you. Hawkeye leads a rebellion in the mess tent under the rallying cry of, we want something else. So in his case, it was liver or fish, liver or fish, liver or fish. And they go on to get an order of Adam's ribs. So maybe you remember that episode. But the we want something else, that is what the American electorate has been saying for a long time. And there would be great excitement and great enthusiasm that they thought, okay, we're going to get something else. And they go, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. And then they would look at the next slate and they would start hearing the same old thing over and over again, and then there would be this disaffection. And so when someone came along who really did sound like something else, and you know, if Donald Trump isn't something else, I don't know what it is. And that was back in 1975. So that's been resonating in my mind. Back in the caucus season, when I was doing polling for the combined forces of Bloomberg Politics and the Des Moines Register, we asked a poll, and I'm sorry for those of you in the back, this got a little small, about your feelings about the U.S. government. We had a very small percentage on both sides, Republican and Democrat, and that's a Democrat on your right, that, you know, kind of ironically enough, Republicans on your left, who said they're happy with the state of the U.S. government. Oh, well, more Democrats said that they were satisfied than Republicans because they had a Democrat in the White House. unsatisfied, mad as hell. Again, I don't use profanity. I pushed back against having that, but journalists like headlines, and so they wanted to have that as one of the answer options. But you can see Republicans much more in the dissatisfied, unhappy side of things. Similar question about politicians in general, and much less difference between the two parties. That just unhappy with the way and you can kind of play back in your own mind, just thinking about who the candidates were and what they sounded like. And they sounded like a rerun of all the candidates that they'd heard before and their canned answers and just sort of a reluctance in the electorate to walk down those same roads again. A question I dreamed up, and this kind of came at the last minute, so I always look at this and think, oh, I could have tightened this up. I needed the newsletter editor to make me look a little bit better. But the question was about what is the greater risk? And this is now a national poll of likely voters, and this was taken in June of 2016. Is the greater risk to elect a president who has not held office, so does not know the processes and procedures of governing? And you can see that the majority of Democrats said that was the greater risk. Or is the greater risk to elect the same sort of person who served as president for many decades, who would likely continue to do things the way they have been done with the same effect? And 55% of Republicans said, oh no, doing the same thing, that's the greater risk. And that explains a lot about why the election turned out the way it did. You could see all of this beginning to happen in the 2016 caucuses in Iowa. And one of the points I like to make when I'm speaking outside of Iowa is about how it is that anyone can come to Iowa and win. And that's one of the reasons that it's a good idea to start in Iowa, because anyone. And I'm going to show you Bernie Sanders, who started out the first time we polled on the caucuses with 3%. So really, almost anybody can get 3%. and what happened as we polled over the course of the caucus campaign is that he only rose. He never dropped in terms of his standing in the poll. He only rose until, you know, they were very, very close at the end, and you know that it was less than one delegate equivalent as they counted the votes on caucus night. Well, it took them a while longer for them to get it that close. But there's no stronger story about Iowa being a place where someone relatively unknown can come and do very well. Now, the Republican side was slightly more, shall I say, chaotic, with a lot of ups and downs of who's winning, who's not winning. And this isn't even all the candidates, because there were 17 of them, which as a pollster, you go, no, do not make me poll on 17 candidates. We ended up in our final poll with Trump leading, but as we all know, that Ted Cruz ended up winning that night. But I want to, before I explain that a little bit, I want to show you how volatile that is, really, up until the very, very end. That final week is exceptionally riddled with change. So this is a vote that solidifies very late, and I carry this graph around with me, but I could do it almost, I'll show you a few others too. In 2004, everybody thought Howard Dean had this locked in, and he started out very close on the first 2 days of polling, but he just went, boom. So we called this the registered graph of doom for Howard Dean, and you know that led to the famous scream. That John Kerry just got stronger. John Edwards also got stronger at the expense of Howard Dean. But the same thing happened. Obama got stronger as Hillary Clinton declined. That was in 2008. It says 2007 because we finished polling in 2007. We don't ever want caucuses on January 3rd again. But, oh yes, we did. We had that again in the 2012 caucuses. This one, we had Ron Paul with a substantial lead on the first night of polling, and then he was down in third place by the final night. We were so struck on the first day of polling that Santorum, who had been sitting at about 5% on every poll since we'd started, had suddenly broken into double digits. We thought, wow, Santorum, double digits. And then sort of had that surge that was talked about in my introduction. And we went down to present the data to the register, and they'd already mocked up the graphic for the front page, didn't have Santorum in the picture at all. And they had to call in the graphics person. This is now on New Year's Eve, and a Sunday that day. So bringing them in on overtime to create a whole new look. They weren't very happy with me. I said, don't be mad at me. This is news. And this is your business. And the thing I regret is that when you average that all together, you still ended up with Ron Paul leading over the full 4 days. I said, that's not the story. The story is Santorum is charging forward. And I don't think you should give much play to that four-day average. And on the front page, I wouldn't put that graphic. So what happens? On the front page, they put that graphic with the four-day. So, you know, I have some influence, but not as much as I would like. And you recall, this is the one where, you know, Romney, so we ended up having Romney winning our poll in the end, on at least on the last day. So I went to bed that night. They announced that Romney won. I said, okay, very good. I'm going to count that as a win. Didn't win. So why didn't Trump win the caucuses? Our poll suggested that he would. But this is a little bit of what happens with caucuses. There wasn't very much. We don't have a similar chart showing a big surge for anything that was happening there. There was no big change. But when I went back and took a look at what we were saying the day that we delivered data, there was all of this sort of what we might call hidden strength for Ted Cruz. And in the pollster notes, I wrote, the drill down shows, if anything, stronger alignment with Cruz than Trump, except for the horse race. That there was all of this stuff that we look at that kind of says, well, is this a soft lead or is this a hard lead? What's happening here? And so we could see that Ted Cruz looked good. But it's all, you know, as you know, with caucuses, it's what in the room where it happens. What is it that's going on there? And they knew how to act, the Cruz campaign. And we've heard that, you know, they were just more organized. They were not rookies. They were well informed. I'm going to grab my water if I could. Steven. Okay, so enough memory lane. Where are we now? Well, we have a president with a low approval rating, but his approval rating as it sits today is not the lowest we've ever seen for president, here in Iowa anyway. So we have the luxury with the Iowa poll to be able to go back for many, many, many presidents. This year is the 75th anniversary of the Iowa poll. It is the longest continuously running statewide newspaper poll. I think now these days we can take out some of those qualifiers. I think it's probably the longest running statewide poll period at this point because many polls have been dropping. But you can see, we start with Eisenhower. I have to kind of tell this to you. And you can see that his numbers were consistently high, that top line in green. We had John Kennedy. You see Lyndon Johnson had some trouble with his approval rating. You see Richard Nixon had some problems with his approval rating. Gerald Ford was always consistently more approved than disapproved. Jimmy Carter started high, ended up with some trouble. Ronald Reagan, people think that he was beloved always, not always. He ended his second term, more disapproval than approval. George H.W. Bush started high, ended with more disapproval than approval. Bill Clinton in Iowa, always more approval than disapproval all the way through his tenure. There was stronger. We also have a feeling thermometer. How do you feel about him? Do you feel favorable, unfavorable? His unfavorables would rise, but that's more of a feeling of effect, of, you know, do you, his personality, but his approval, how he was doing his job as president, that was always quite high. George W. Bush, as you can see, quite high disapproval. Barack Obama ended with some disapproval. So Donald Trump, his disapproval numbers aren't the highest that we've ever seen. What they are the highest we've ever seen in the first year of his first term. So we've pulled out the similar numbers going back to Eisenhower, and you can see that he's the only one that's in negative numbers during the first year of his first term. So that's what's unprecedented here. Where is Iowa in all of this? And I gave this little talk at Grinnell a couple of weeks ago, so you might be wondering why did I bother to pull out little Grinnell. This was Iowa in 2008, and if you count up the red counties versus the blue counties, it's roughly 50-50. That's why Iowa is thought of as a purple state. Here is Iowa in 2016. Little bit of a change there. So people ask me if I think that Iowa is still legitimately thought of, can be thought of as a purple state. And I think what this shows is a very well-organized Republican Party in the state. On election day in 2016, I was in a green room with Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan. She goes, well, what's going on in Iowa? And I said, well, there's not much of a bench in terms of statewide Democratic office, in terms of congressional people who are running. It doesn't appear from an outside observer that there's a lot of people to draw upon for those offices, and Republicans have worked that. But I think because of our redistricting rules, it's always possible for Iowa to change. We do not allow the party that currently holds the seat to lock that in through the way things are redistricted when the census comes around. I thought I would just also show again, because we have this terrific resource that we can look historically and so really put into context what's happening now. We ask in the poll, do you consider yourself in politics, Republican, Democrat, or independent? You can see that for a long time, the plurality has considered themselves independent. And then the Republicans and the Democrats, they sort of flip back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, with not a lot of space in between. So again, that's why I think that Iowa still has to be considered a purple state. Because for now, it appears as though there are slightly more, certainly on a statewide basis for that one election for president. But it's just not the case that there's a strong sweep in terms of political identity. So what do we look forward? I think it is clear that the Trump victory and certainly his presidency has changed politics, and every day I wake up to see how it's changed it yet again. That it changes the way politicians are acting and will act going forward. It changes the way the electorate is acting, will act going forward. There's been no incumbent president who has been underwater like this. That creates some opportunities. Well, maybe John Adams faced some similar difficulties. That's laughter from the Hamilton person in the room. Really, really. Get yourself into the Hamilton thing. Get the soundtrack. Just give it a little time. It will win you over. And I think it will affect the midterms, and I have been saying this since last year, that the midterms are going to surprise us in ways even today we can't really predict. And I think it will also affect the caucuses, who runs and who wins. We've already seen, I've already said at the beginning of this presentation, anyone can come to Iowa and win. And so who gets in and who organizes and who wins? And I think obviously that leads to what happens in 2020 as well. There are interesting developments going on. And again, I need to update this on virtually a daily basis. Both parties are divided internally, both parties. We've had two government shutdowns There was a budget bill that was passed without all Republicans and without DACA. So you had deals that were supposed to be made that were not made. There's the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement, and there's other social activism, and that's bringing a record number of women into politics. And I went looking for some data. I'm a data girl. Like to see what that is. The number of Democratic women who are challenging incumbents in the U.S. House is up about 350%. Here's another number. From 2015 to 2016, about 900 women contacted Emily's List, which is a Democratic group to help women run for office, get money for that. Since Trump took office, it's 26,000. And I mentioned that to somebody and who I thought was number seven. They go, oh, about three times. That sounds about right. I go, no. 900 is almost 1,000. This is 26,000. This is a meaningful thing happening. I went looking for the Republican equivalent of Emily's List, and I could find no such similar piece of data on that. So I don't know if that this is just uniquely on the Democratic side, but I would assume that this could be happening with Republican women as well. I doubt that it would be at a exponential level that we're seeing here. I don't know if you're aware, in Kansas, there are no qualifications to run for statewide office, so there are six teenagers who will be on the ballot running for governor. The quote of one is, let's try something new that has never really been tried anywhere else before. And I go back to Hawkeye. We want something else. We want something else. And he said, okay, well, we're something else. We're teenagers. Let's do it. And probably their stock went up after the Parkland kids and how brilliant they have been in terms of talking to the media and creating what may be a social movement with some legs to it. The never again is activating Americans who are too young to vote. We know anecdotally, what we don't know in any sort of traditional polling way is the influence children have on their parents. But I know from focus groups that I've done on issues having to do with environment, on issues having to do with marriage equality, that children influence their parents and sort of normalize things that might not have been the way that a parent might have thought about things before. In special elections since the inaugurations, Democrats are running an average of 10 points higher than Trump did in those districts. Now, that can happen two ways. Trump could have been above the average, or Democrats could be above the average of where those used to be. So that they're just restoring the average that had been there before. And I'm looking at Republicans' positioning that if Trump stays, he's announced he has a new campaign manager for 2020, so he appears to be positioning to run for re-election. But there are Republicans positioning to perhaps challenge him. Good for my business if he does. So you've got Jeff Flake and Ben Sasse, Marco Rubio, Mitt Romney, Rand Paul, people who are pushing on the president. I think we had almost a year of the Republicans in the Senate kind of frozen in place, not really knowing how to deal with being at odds with the president. And now you're sort of seeing a few step out and figure out what they're going to do about that. And you will all recall the moment when John McCain came in at the last moment to vote down on the Obamacare change. And I thought at the moment, I'm wondering if there will be people who want to restore regular order, want the Senate to return to the way things had run before, who will say, I'm running as a John McCain Republican. Don't know. Just sort of crossed my mind there. And there certainly is a model for interesting ways of changing in terms of social movements and rapid change in how quickly public opinion changed on marriage equality. Again, that was unprecedented within one administration, really 180 degrees of change from sort of no, don't endorse it to yes, do endorse it. I mean, it was rather remarkable. And it did not require voting out people in order to affect change. It involved changing people's minds. I'll mention that before the Iowa Supreme Court announced their decision on that, I was hired to do some focus groups. And I was in Cedar Rapids, and we wanted to sort of figure out where ordinary people, to the extent that that exists, where they were on marriage equality. And so we recruited several groups, but the one I want to tell you about was a group of women who didn't have a dog in the hunt. So they didn't have children or other family members or close friends or work associates who were gay or lesbian. We just wanted them to be kind of clear of having some vested interest. And brought them in, 10 of them, to a table. And I started out the conversation by asking them, well, how many of you consider that you're in a traditional marriage? Because they were all married. And only one of them raised their hand. And I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. So I said, well, in what way is your marriage not traditional? Went around the table. Well, I'm older than my husband. Well, I am the breadwinner in the family. Well, we lived together before we got married. Well, we didn't get married in the church. Well, I mean, they had all of these ways that they thought of their marriage as non-traditional. And it sort of started a conversation about what does marriage mean and what binds people together and ways in which you're sort of going against the countervailing values of a community. And we chatted along and chatted along. And it was one of those charmed groups that doesn't happen all that often where, as a moderator, I needed only to kind of nudge them. They were engaging each other and asking each other questions and talking along. And then we showed a video that showed gay and lesbian parents and talked about the challenges they had in raising children and what they were up to and the sort of everyday challenges any parent faces in raising children. And then one woman said, you know, in kind of summing up her challenges, every time I have to fill out a form and mark that my marital status is single, I feel like I'm lying. And that kind of came back when toward the end. And as we were coming around to sum up, I said, are you aware that the Supreme Court is about to decide if the Iowa Constitution allows for gay and lesbian couples to marry, whether that's embedded in our Constitution? No, they were not aware. I said, well, how do you think you'll feel if the Supreme Court decides that that's what our Constitution allows? And there's a pause. And then one woman says, well, I think I'd feel proud. And I said, well, how many of you agree with Sharon? And 9 hands go up. And I said, okay, now this is interesting because you're all invited here because, the part I didn't tell you, they recruited on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being I'm all for marriage equality, we probably phrased it some other way, 1 being I'm completely opposed. They were 4, 5, or 6. So we wanted people in the middle of that. So you got in this room because you're a 4, 5, or 6, so explain to me. And they said, you know, it's not our issue. And I've never had a conversation like the one we just had. So I'm now thinking about things. This is, their issues are my issues. They're raising kids like I'm raising kids. You know, it was a very interesting sort of thing that happened, which was suddenly I saw how fast this thing could go if people just started having the conversation. That as long as it was a closeted conversation where people were just talking amongst themselves with people who already agreed, it was going to take a long time. But to kind of open up that conversation and invite, you know, the kinds of just curiosity questions about why not in a way that was not, you know, confrontative, but just sort of opening how far and how fast public opinion can change. And we may be seeing it on some other issues as well. Time will tell. But obviously that has served as an interesting experience that I had. So if things are changing, as I close almost all of my speeches, You have to think about how you want to be a part of it. So in communication theory, which is my background academically, Paul Václavic said you cannot not communicate. That is, your sheer standing here, not uttering a thing, still communicates something. And my corollary to that is you cannot not participate. That the act of not participating is still showing up in terms of what is happening in our country. So, with that, do we have time for questions or did I talk too long?
No, you're fine. Questions?
Yes, sir.
One of the things I've noticed in the as people start to advertise for the upcoming election is I noticed that one of the candidates uses time for the next generation. And that particularly holds something for me as an older gay man. And I'm going, yeah, it is time for some fresh ideas. And I'm wondering if you've had any sense of that through your polling, that there's this generational thing that's getting ready to happen.
I hear it, it's hard for me to answer that without the context of the Never Again movement. And we'll see if it has legs. There's this march that's being organized. There are things that are happening because these remarkably educated children in a high school in Florida know how to speak out. They happen to have been in their debate and forensics team working on gun control. So they've got a command that I find fascinating. And they've got media training. So whenever I'm interviewed by the press, they say, talk to the interviewer, and here's the camera. And those kids, boom. I mean, they just pivot and talk into the camera. And it's very interesting. And I heard maybe one of their first interviews say, what do you say to the people who, this is the day after, what do you say to the people who say it's too soon to be talking about this? And he said, I'd say it's too late. It's too late. 17 people died yesterday. It's too late. Why haven't we begun talking about this? We have to start talking. And it sort of was turning the thing. And the too soon, you'd already heard it, and you just thought, here we go again. Here we go again. And I don't, how many of you saw the CNN town hall? A few of you. And, give credit to Marco Rubio for walking into that, because that took a lot of, I think he figured, I've got nothing to lose, I've got everything to gain if I can do it. And he is rhetorically more adept than many. So he was able to pivot occasionally and do something, but you'd hear his first talking point sound stale, sound like we'd heard that before. And so I think it's that we want something else being echoed again. That there is, again, in the electorate, we don't want to hear that same argument again on this. And I think it may come through in some other ways too. You want something else. So I hear it, and I think it's there. I can't tell you I see it necessarily in the polling. But what the companies that are doing, what Dick's Sporting Goods is doing, is tapping into things we do know in polling, which are millennials, which are now bigger than the baby boom generation. They buy things based on values. They align based on values. So I have done a fair amount of work for Fairway stores. And we invite people in who've not been to the stores. We've sent them a shopping card. We send them to the store, and then tell us about your experience in the store. And they go, oh, the store at 63rd and Grand. They go, well, you can tell that store has been there a long, long time. And I go, I know my clients in the back room are going, ugh. They've just stabbed them in the heart because that's a brand new building. So I come around at the end of the group and go, what now? What made you think that was old? And they said, oh, well, just the materials that they're using. It's so out of date. It's just, you can tell it's just old. And I said, well, what if you knew that, this is a company that's 75 years old. There was two families that was engineers were founded, and they figured out how to be, how to take the heating and cooling that they were using for the produce and turn that into heating and cooling for the HVAC, the air conditioning and heating, and so they're very energy efficient, and they didn't know how energy efficient they were until they bought a Safeway store with the same square footage, and it took, I'm going to make these numbers up, 16 compressors to run that store, and it only took 7 to run their Fairway store. It's very energy efficient. You go, oh, I want to support a store that's energy efficient. That's a beautiful store. So that's, you know, suddenly they now see it in a different way because of the values that are there. They're very values driven, and it will change quite literally the way they see things. So, you know, politicians are going to have to react to that. It'll change the way they hear things too. Yes?
You're more of a data person, obviously, than tea leaves person, but with what I think could be perceived as overreach in the legislature recently, you see Chris Hagenow switching districts rather than running in a competitive one. Is there any data indicator this far out that you know the Iowa House is in play, or that there could be significant gains made just because of the mood of the electorate?
I always think the Iowa state legislature can be in play. And again, I'm showing you more national numbers because I play more statewide than at that district by district level. You know, the Senate is very close, so one always has to think that that's possible there. But I sort of bring you back to my pipeline issue. Are there enough people in the pipeline who can successfully challenge? So I think that's someone who knows more about how things are working out district by district could give you a more informed answer than I can give you. Yes?
In this collecting and analyzing your data, do you ever correlate that with the amount of fundraising that is either going on or is going on in support of a particular candidate or party? Do you correlate that?
Well, correlate it. In terms of what? Do we take it into account?
In terms of predicting what's going on here, is more fundraising in a particular party an indicator that, by gosh, that's going to translate into an election win?
This is another of the ways that Donald Trump's victory changes things, because he didn't raise the most money. He didn't spend the most money. So it can be done without that traditional way of doing things. I'm reminded of a question I got saying, you know, in your algorithm of how you put this together, do you take into account yard signs? And I stopped for a minute. I said, yes, to the extent that yard signs influence the people I'm talking to on the phone about how they're going to vote, yes, that's factored in. The only time we take fundraising into account is when we've got a long list of candidates and we've got to decide who we're going to include in our poll, because we can't include everybody in the poll. So somebody not included in the poll called me up a little bit ago and said, hey, how come I'm not included in the poll? And I'm looking at the fundraising report, and I said, well, we included people who had raised over $300,000. And I don't say out loud that he'd raised $1,600 and had, you know, $175 cash on hand, which I think most 28-year-olds might have. Maybe the 6 teenagers in Kansas, you know, have that. So I didn't say that. But he said, well, you should look at other metrics. I go, nominate other metrics for us to take a look at. We'd be happy to. And I think we need to be looking at other metrics. We might need to be looking at how many followers do you have on Facebook or Twitter. We might need to be reaching out to see what kind of impact people are having beyond those traditional ways of judging if you're a real campaign. Do you have an office in the state? Because organizing has changed a lot. Yeah, follow up.
Follow-up question. I want to learn a little bit about this margin of error business.
Okay.
I can see that if you called everybody, then you have a little margin of error shrinkage with people changing their mind.
That's not sampling error, but okay.
Yeah. But I see your polls that come out, and they say there's a margin of error, 3% plus or minus. Two questions. If you know what the margin of error is, why don't you correct it? And two, if it's plus or minus, does that mean you might be 6% off?
Yes.
Or 3%.
Okay. So here's the way it works. You have a universe of people who are going to vote on election day. That's everybody. Well, we could call everybody. It takes a lot of money. Happy to do it. If you've got a client that wants us to do that, we're happy. We're available. But we want to talk to a small group of people who look like the big group of people. But there's sampling error, and that's what a margin of error tells you. You know, you're plus or minus this many points. So let's say it's 3. So what that means is that if I have a race that's 3 points apart, that it could be closer, it could be farther apart. And the little soapbox I get on with reporters is that they want to say, well, there's a plus or minus 3 points, and it's a 3-point race. It's a dead heat. And I say, you need to also say it could be. It's equally likely it could be even farther apart. And for you to only say the one without saying the other reflects bias. And then they get very upset by that, and they hang up the phone. They don't want to talk to me anymore because they want to say it's a dead heat. And as a statistician, I want them to just say what the poll says. Just say, our best estimate is that it's a 3-point race. That's the best estimate. Any other saying it's a dead heat is an inferior estimate of the race. Did that help?
Evangelicals have long held quiet standing in elections in Iowa in particular, and you can almost predict who the Republican nominee will be by just looking at who's the most pious and who has met with the most religious leaders in their camp and so on. And I'm curious if there's any sense that that is changing and that is becoming less important with their support.
With their support for Trump. In our last poll, I believe evangelicals were the only subgroup that we analyzed that had a more positive than, besides Republicans, who obviously approve, evangelicals are also quite high in their support of Donald Trump. So they're kind of the rock solid core. And you ask yourself, how could that be? And they will say, when you talk to them, well, we're all flawed. But he's with us. And, you know, I'm reminded that very early on, there was a New Hampshire focus group, and I think John Heilman, who was then with Bloomberg Politics, led in New Hampshire with Trump supporters. And this was at a time when people didn't understand how there could be Trump supporters, because the media thought he was a clown. I mean, that was the word they used. So I said, why is it? Why are you supporting Donald Trump? And they just kind of said, well, he's one of us. And John Heilman had the presence of mind to say, what do you mean? He's a billionaire and he flies around on his private jet. And they go, oh no, he talks like we talk. He thinks about things the way we think about things. And so I think there's kind of that similar sense of identity that evangelicals see, because they think, you know, they're probably flawed too. So when you say pious, well, how does that play out in their everyday life, really? So it's more of a mindset than an activity set, it'd be my guess. Yes?
I'm reminded, when you say that, of a movie I saw as a little kid about when Jimmy Walker was mayor of New York, there was a scene and they smoked proverbial smoke-filled room, and the line I remember out of it is, well, he may be a son of a bitch, but at least he's our son of a bitch.
Exactly. I think there's some of that. Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a question as far as, I think traditionally, polling has been done over the telephone, with more and more people dropping their landlines and cell phones, especially for the younger people having just a cell phone, not getting a landline. How does that affect your polling? Or how do you still just need landlines? Or?
No, we do both. In fact, being able to call cell phones has helped us connect with younger people. Now, the trick is that it's more expensive to call people on their cell phones. Why is that? When we call you on your landline, where do we reach you?
At home.
When we call, so maybe you have time to talk to us for a few minutes. When we call you on your cell phone, where do we reach you? Could be anywhere, could be driving, could be all of that. So it may take more times to try you until we find you at a convenient time. But for now, we're not having the difficulties that we used to have.
And the phone numbers from the providers, like AT&T, the phone numbers for cell phones, or how many, we're not in the phone book.
Right. You know, when I first came to the register in 87, we had a whole collection of Iowa phone books, and then my secretary would go through and pick every nth number. And we'd throw that into a computer, drop the last two digits, and do a random. I mean, we did it all by hand. We work with a sample provider now who does that kind of thing for us. Yeah.
When you call me on your cell phone, who does my caller ID say that the call's coming from? Because I won't answer it if it's Mr. Unknown Name.
You know, that's a really, nobody's ever asked me that before. I know that when I'm called by PPP, it says Olwine, Iowa. Mm-hmm. I shall find out. Yeah. Yes?
Back to Jonathan's question on error in your numbers. I'm a retired chemist, so I kind of understand errors in my field, but your margin of error is a little more difficult to determine. You have a margin of error in your margin of error, and how do you determine that number?
Well, the margin of error we report out is sampling error. That is the difference between talking to a small group of people and doing a census, where we would talk to everyone. But there are other kinds of error. There's coverage error. Because there's some people who show up on voting day and they don't have a phone at all. So there's no way that we could reach them. That's coverage error. So they're outside the possibility of. So.
But how do you determine what that number is, whether it's 3 or 6 or?
The coverage error or the sampling error? Okay, well, there's a formula. If I had a chalkboard, I'd write it up there. But you take a big square root sign and then you put 50 times 50, which is the most conservative way to do it. So that's P times 1 minus P divided by N minus 1, take the square root, and multiply it by 1.96. I know he can do this in his head. and voila.
So you're pretty much as a guest. I mean, it's
it's called statistics class.
Yes.
So it's what we learned in school. So it's the same thing there that you learned in your college class. So it's not just a guess. It's a time-tested method, just like your sciences as well.
Were you kidding when you said it was a guess? Because I'm telling you that's the formula. It doesn't account for all the error.
Woo!
And thank you very much for this fascinating, informative presentation. I've been looking forward to it for a long, long time. And I think I understand a little bit better about this margin of error business. I had a friend who said that in his next life, he wanted to either be an astronaut or a weather forecaster. And I thought he must have a split personality. In the one, there is no margin of error at all. And in the other, that's all there is error. I've decided in my next lifetime, I want to do what you do. This is fascinating stuff. And to the extent that it can be predictive, I think some of the indicators are sort of hopeful signs of change. And if it can be properly packaged and managed and organized, why the change might actually happen. Thank you very much for coming and sharing with us today. It's a tradition to give a token of appreciation to our speakers, and I have for you a CD of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus. Thank you for coming. All right. Next month, we're going to be having Sergeant Paul Parazak, who is the usual spokesperson for the Des Moines Police Department, who sort of comes on the scene after some horrific thing has happened, and he has remarkable ability to speak in understandable ways about what is going on and what has happened and how it's being dealt with. He's a very handsome man in uniform, Thank you, Brian Taylor Carlson, for that inspiration. So you'll want to be here for sure to hear Sergeant Perezek. And then in May, May 4th meeting, is going to be a follow-up fascinating presentation to what we've heard this morning. Our speaker in May is going to be Keith Snow. He is CEO of B2E. It's a data mining and marketing firm. So he sort of mines the data that folks like Ann Zelzer generate and targets various subgroups. If you give him two or three pieces of information, such as your license plate number and your age and maybe one other piece of information, he can tell you what kind of dog food you buy. It's an amazing ability to dissect this data and then target market to various demographics. We hired him out at the zoo, for example, and he took information from driver's license plates from a camera that he had mounted up there and gave us some just startling information about when grandparents were there with grandchildren and therefore how to market to them for that time and this kind of an event. It was an amazing thing. And so you can come and learn about yourself on the presentation on May the 4th. At any rate, we hope to see you in April. Look over the material on your tables for schedule of events for the remainder of this month and get your copy for the newsletter to me by the 12th. And thank you for being here this afternoon. Thanks.